Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the January 10th, 2021, first of the year personal theology presentation. Thank you all for being here today. We're trying something a little different today. We're having a trio of some of our many talented members talk today about the idea of creation and spirituality and how that works in their life, or maybe it doesn't. So I'm going to introduce the speakers, and then we will move in order from one to the second to the third, and Evelie will finish with a song, and then we will have Q&A after that. So our first speaker is Lynn Hammond, and she grew up loving literature, and I like that she secretly let us know that she used to read under the blanket at night with a flashlight, which I'm sure many of us can relate to when we're supposed to be lights out. She first went to Duke University, and then she got her PhD from USC in 1974. And since then, she's been devising creative ways of teaching writing and literature. And we're going to hear her story today after she created that program at Bard. Next will be Deborah Schmidt, who has been a member of church for several years. She is also a member of the choir, as are the other two women today. And she has also been board president, so we thank her for her duty for doing that. She has moved into poetry and is now a published poet, and she will talk about her spiritual move into that particular venue of communication. And last but certainly not least will be Evelie. Where are you, Evelie? Evelie Delfino Sales Posh. Many of us know her by her beautiful voice and her solos. And she will talk about her spiritual journey of music and writing. So I'm now going to turn it over to Lynn Hammond, and she will give her presentation. Thanks, everyone.
Hi. So when Anne asked us to write about how our creativity relates to our spirituality, I wasn't sure mine was related. So I'm going to talk mainly about creativity as it relates to my love of English and teaching, and a little bit about spirituality. So I'm going to start in the eighth grade when I was invited to give a talk to my whole school from the seventh through the 12th grade. They asked me to give a talk at the chapel, in the chapel service, the weekly chapel service. And I don't know why anyone thought that at age 14, I should be talking to the whole school, but anyway, they asked me to do it, so I did it. And what I talked about was the parable of the talents. And this isn't Unitarian language, but we talked about using your God-given talents. So not burying them under a bushel, but using them. And I linked that to my questioning then about what was the purpose of my life. And it was clear to me that that the purpose of my life was to leave the world better than I found it. So I was going to talk about both literature and writing, but it got too long. So I'm only going to talk about my teaching of writing. But to start with, my first experience that I remember of having to write myself was in the eighth grade when we had read a book called Johnny Tremaine. And I was supposed to write a book report. But I loved the book, and I loved Mrs. Paolucci, my teacher, but I didn't know how to write a book report. My mother helped, and so after that, I got A's in my writing and was even chosen to be the editor of my school magazine, but writing was mostly a chore. So now I want to have a little audience participation. How many of you used to put off writing school papers until the night before they were due? Please raise your hand. So when I entered the University of Southern California for graduate school, I had a TA-ship, which meant I taught two classes and graded 50 papers each week. I quickly realized many of the accepted pedagogical practices were counterproductive. The usual paradigm for teaching writing was to analyze a good essay in class and say to students, "Go ye and do likewise." That method, I discovered, helped some students, but it intimidated more. They didn't know how to write an essay. So I started looking for ways to lead them through the process of writing a paper. luckily I met a wonderful man named Peter Elbow, and we created a whole process. So instead of starting off and having like a rough draft, we would start off and say, so here's a topic. What are your attitudes toward authority? And then what are your first thoughts? Who are people you've known that were authority figures? Who was a good authority? Who's an authority figure that you admitted, that you admired, and who's one that you didn't? And so we helped them have all these different, bring together all these different pieces of their experience of authority before they actually then took a stand. So, and it was all done through free writing, which is writing that doesn't, you don't worry about audience at first. You're just writing whatever's on your mind. So anyway, the other problem with writing pedagogy, and this is what I'm really going to talk about today. So the other problem, in addition to not knowing how to start or not having a process, was that most student writing was what I call made up writing, writing to please the teacher, often on topics chosen by the teacher, topics on which the teacher was the expert, which created the temptation to regurgitate the teacher's opinions, which just creates dead writing. You're just trying to please. So instead of figure out what you really think. So I started looking for real situations for students to write about where they actually had something they wanted to communicate to a specific audience. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples. My first job was at College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine. I had written my dissertation on Aldous Huxley, and two of his ideas that really influenced me were that courses should be interdisciplinary and experiential. So I designed a course called Reading, Writing, and Roaming. College of the Atlantic is in Bar Harbor, Maine, and John McPhee had recently written an essay about a 100-mile canoe trip he had taken on the St. John's River, a wild river that was under the threat of damming by the Army Corps of Engineers. It was the last undammed river in Maine, and we were told then it was the last undammed river in east of the Mississippi, but I tried to find out if that was true last night. I wasn't able to find that out. I decided this was a worthwhile project. So we read McPhee. I taught everybody how to canoe. We engaged a photographer and waited for the ice to break so we could follow McPhee's route down the river. We took pictures as we paddled down the river. It was about a 7-day trip. We each took notes during the day and took pictures. And then at night we would share our notes about what we'd experienced and what we'd seen. So then when we got home, we all put out everything we'd written, and we created a collage and then a photo essay that was published and got a big spread in the local newspaper showing why this river should be left to flow wild. I can't claim that our essay had decisive impact, but in fact, the proposed Dickey Lincoln Dam has never been built. And we all felt we had had a part in preserving this beautiful river. Students could see that writing had a purpose, could accomplish things, and it wasn't just a made-up exercise to please the teacher. So that was my first attempt at wanting to have situations that were real writing, that had some purpose, rather than made-up stuff for the teacher. The second example is, when I was teaching freshman English at UC Santa Barbara, there was this tall, handsome man who named Landau, but he was the only Black in the class. He came to class, but he wouldn't write papers. I would run into him on campus and I'd say, Landau, I need you to write papers. I can't give you credit in a writing class just for coming to class. And he said, I don't need to learn how to write. I'm going to be an engineer. And I thought about saying, well, you might have a girlfriend sometime that you might want to write a letter to. But anyway, I didn't say that. But I kept running into him on campus. And so one day I said, well, so how are you doing? And he said, well, I'm sad because my girlfriend broke up with me. And we talked a little more. And it turned out that her parents, she was white, he was black, her parents had insisted that she break up with him. So I said, well, so are you angry about that? And he said, well, I'm just used to it. And so then I asked him some more. I said, well, have you experienced other discrimination recently or in your life? And he said, well, I rushed for fraternity and I wasn't accepted. And I said, well, are you angry about that? And he said, it's just, there's nothing to be done. You know, it's just how it is. So I said, you know, the students in our class need to hear about this. And so I asked him to write it up. And he said, I won't share it with the class, but I'll write it to you. And I said, okay, write it as a letter to me, but and I won't share it with anybody. Just write it to me. Well, he wrote this very powerful letter about all this discrimination he had experienced. And I said again to him, the students need to know this. The other students in this class need to hear this. So he eventually did read it to the class. It was really lovely. They were very empathetic. They reached out to him. He had lots of new friends. And he then wrote papers from then on. And he ended up graduating high in his class 4 years later. So my last example is when I was teaching at the University of UC Santa Barbara in the Graduate School of Education. And it was a required class for anyone who was going for a teaching credential. And I walked into the class and there were all these tall, thin, blonde, blue-eyed women. But as we talked, so they were sort of the stereotype of what some people would think of as Southern California beach girls. But it turned out that they were all very self-conscious about their bodies. They all thought they were too fat. And so I decided to assign Naomi Wolf's The Beauty Myth, which, as some of you may know, posits that our culture accepts and even propagates very narrow ideals of feminine beauty. And then she gives many examples of all the negative consequences for men as well as women. And I said to my students, you know, my generation, I was 44 at the time, my generation really worked hard to free you all from this kind of feeling of the beauty myth. Anyway, I also asked each of them to look through current magazines and find an ad they found offensive that fit in with our discussion of the beauty myth. Their assignment was to write a letter to the editor of the magazine, locating the ad by volume and page number, and then describing what was sexist or offensive. The great thing was they received responses from magazines apologizing, offering to change, and sometimes giving other perks like free subscriptions. I think it was the first time any of those students had ever thought that writing could be useful, could accomplish something. So for the rest of the semester, we had very lively written and verbal exchanges on topics they cared about. So now fast forward, this was my sixth year, excuse me, I need to take a little drink. This was my sixth year at UC Santa Barbara, and I knew I wouldn't receive tenure. I hadn't told my students until a few days before the end of the semester. My announcement created an uproar with these grad students and also with my freshmen. They created what they called chalk-ins, where they got all these different beautiful colors of chalk and wrote on all the sidewalks on the campus, "Keep Lynn Hammond, she's the best teacher we've ever had." They also wrote letters to the campus newspaper. They got articles of the Santa Barbara newspaper and even interviews on the Santa Barbara television. I had nothing to do with all this. No one consulted me. No one took credit, but I was very proud of them. I felt I had done my job. This was all 30 years ago, and I like to think that they have continued to stand up for things, that they found their voice, they felt empowered, and that they have used their writing ever since. So if I go back to the parable of the talents, I like to think that I helped them find their voice, find their power, and that they've been using it ever since. I don't know. Anyway, then 2 months later, I moved across the country to live in an ashram in Lenox, Massachusetts. So thank you for sharing, for listening. I'm sharing. Thank you for listening. As I'm ending, I want to turn to Deborah Schmidt, whose creativity I've admired since I first encountered it almost 20 years ago, and who has quietly become a published poet over the past few years.
Thank you, Lynn, and what a pleasure to hear these stories. Lynn has been an incredible writing coach for me, a very important support. And thank you, everybody, for being here. I'm going to start by just giving you a little background about who I am and how I arrived here at this community. I was one of those kids on the playground that everybody came up to and said, "What are you?" I came from a very mixed background ethnically and religiously, and my family had spiritual practice and religions that ran the gamut from Masonry, various forms of Protestantism, including Quakerism, to Judaism. And on top of that, I had this unique upbringing in Taos, where with two parents who were devoted to exposing me to a wide variety of spiritual practices, including things that we were uniquely exposed to there, like the Pueblo earth-based spirituality and this incredibly intense and sometimes even violent brand of Northern New Mexico Catholicism. Another very strong thread in my life has always been reading, this unstoppable inhalation of books as a child that has continued. And at that point, it was especially fairy tales and folk tales. And one of my very favorite books that has continued to be seminal in my thinking was by our own Sophia Foss, the UU educator from long ago and many lands, collection of folk tales. Music was another very strong thread right through my childhood into adulthood, along with a close relationship to nature, which was certainly intensified by the place I grew up in, which was so incredibly beautiful. And in adulthood, probably the most formational element has been my experience of parenting, which I'm sure many of you have shared. I can't think of any other thing that has just opened my heart more than that, with both joy and sorrow. So I'm going to read an excerpt from a poem that I wrote for a service here, actually, so some of you may recognize it, called Coming Home. Where has this heart broken open finally come home to rest? Can you think of any other church where the strands and colors of our lives are so entwined together and made whole? The stories I loved from long ago and many lands, with all their paths to truth, are honored here. Here in the silence, the still small voice is listened for and heard. The mystery of the Latin Mass, the Pueblo reverence for the earth, the candlelight, the braided loaves, and music making many one, all here. And best of all, the friends whose smiles across the room let you know that you've come home to let go and begin again in love. And now that I've shared with you a little about my background and what has drawn me to this community, I will attempt to address the very big question of the day that Anne has laid before us about the intersection of spirituality and creativity. And of course, I can really only answer this from my own experience. For me, creativity begins with being present and open. So I'd like to read you a small poem that is really all about that. This one's called The Apricot Tree. Look now and see, vibrant with light on this December morning, the apricot in all its lucent glory, each leaf aglow against rain-burnished bark. One last night wind and every leaf will leave its tender mooring to lie on the ground in a perfect circle, fallen like Zeus to Danae in the dark. So being present and open is reliant to a very high degree upon being able to access a place of stillness. For one of our December services, which was focused on stillness, I wrote this poem called The Stillness Between, which I'd like to share with you now. The Stillness Between. There is a stillness between, as essential to creation as the air that surrounds us. Stillness is liminal, a threshold state, a sacred turning point. It is a waiting for what is to come, advenire, advent. It is a faithful abiding, expectation, expectationem. It is at once release and receptivity, a letting go and a letting in. Between sleeping and waking, stillness is that rosy hush just before the first birds. Between one wave and the next, stillness is the gathering of the ocean's power. Between speakers at a Quaker meeting, stillness is a waiting for the spirit and a pondering of all that has been shared. Between stanzas for the reader, stillness is space for reflection and possibility. Between poems for the writer, stillness is gestational. Between musical events or phrases, stillness or silence is necessary to completion. My favorite composers are the ones who are unafraid of silence, who, like the ocean, use stillness as generative. Music heard is made potent by the unheard, by the emotive force that multiplies as listeners lean in, filling the voids with visions of their own. In the stillness of dawn, we begin to hear the first birds sing. In the stillness between waves, we feel through our feet the deep vibrations of earth and sea. Between stanzas or poems, we can sense the opening of our minds. Through musical rests, we are carried by the stirrings of dreams. In the silences of meeting, we are moved by that of God in everyone. And in breaths between thoughts, we listen for the voice of our own loving hearts. And here's an excerpt from another poem written for worship service, Ways of the Spirit, that also addresses how creativity begins in a sacred place, a place without words, without boundaries. It also speaks to the experience of being increasingly unable to separate the mundane from the spiritual. And this is just an excerpt. And as for me, it seems I can no longer separate everyday being from the life of the spirit. Cooking with family, eating together, appreciating the small things that all of us do for this, our home. Caring for the garden, watching the goldfish in the pool, listening to the songs of birds and seeing them be drawn up magically into the sheltering trees. Playing or singing, entering that world of music without words, without boundaries, where love and mystery wait for us. And writing, especially poetry, beginning in that same wordless place, receptive to the words that might make the sacred manifest. In all these things, I am constantly learning to open my heart, to lose myself to live with gratitude. And here's one about that process of finding the words, a process that I love, but that continues to be very mysterious to me. And this poem returns to the threshold concept referred to in The Stillness Between, or I should say presages, because this poem is a pretty early one from the days when Daniel and I were courting, but separated by thousands of miles and writing love letters to bridge the distance. This is called the Lyman, which means the threshold. Subtitle is, Where Do Words Hide When the Being Is Too Full? I open to words along the limb, the Lyman, where being extends unfettered into knowing, where images flash freely, be together like raindrops hanging backlit from a branch, and pull with an ache at all that lies beneath. And I'd like to end with a poem that has come to symbolize for me a very felicitous aspect of the spirituality of creativity, and that is synergy. I wrote this in response to an archaeological find about a creative person from long, long ago. And I sent it to the archaeologist concerned on a total whim, who then shared it with his wife, who just happened to be an incredible visual artist. And she is now planning to create a piece based on the poem. So this for me is just a great example of how creativity flourishes when our spirits are open, not just to the world, but to each other. This is called Bones of the Potter. For 3,000 years, her bones have lain at Eleftherna, becoming intertwined with olive roots. Hers are not the bones of a priestess, symmetrical and pristine. They show hard and singular use. Muscles on the right, more developed, knees and hips smoothed to ivory. Anthropologists tried to read her story, but even digital magic could not model a way of life that sculpted such bones. She had not been a laundress or a weaver, a reaper or a baker of bread. A chance encounter with a living Cretan ceramicist solved the riddle. Kicking a wheel taxed those joints. Leaning to shape the spinning clay built those muscles. A potter of the Homeric age, she threw piti, vessels as tall as a man, used for grain and wine, but also burials. She would have been part of a thriving city of the living who tended to the needs of the dead, grave diggers, flower sellers, stone cutters, weavers of shrouds. She would always have worked with others whose hands joined hers to lift, center, raise, and fire such colossal amounts of clay. Close your eyes against the white Cretan sun. Breathe in wild thyme. Taste the earthiness of moist terracotta. The lapis air rings with the sistra of cicadas. There she is, under an awning, centering beehives of clay twice her own weight. She opens a well in the mound, a daily act of love and creation, and the pitos begins to rise, silky, grainy, cool to her touch, fluid in form, responsive to every message from her hands. She throws one enormous layer and then another, carefully sealing them together, leaving no pockets of air to explode in the kiln. She feeds the fire with crushed olive stones and grape seeds until it glows like a sliced persimmon. Perhaps she never imagined she would be a storyteller, but the story written on her bones has survived millennia to reach us, connecting us across the centuries, making of time a circle as true as the rim of the rising clay. Thank you. And now I will turn this over to Evelie, who is truly one of our musical treasures and an amazing creative powerhouse. Evelie.
Thank you so much, Deborah and Lynn, for your sharing. And that inspired me as well. So I didn't prepare anything because improvisation is one of the things that I love to do. So I was taking a few notes, but listening very deeply. And I just like to start off by a land acknowledgement to say that I am here on Huichin Chochenyo Ohlone land, sacred land, and giving thanks for this space that we are able to be here, and to ask for forgiveness for our collective harm that we have done to the peoples, the original peoples of this land. And I'd like to say hello to my ancestors and cover your ears. I'm going to blow a conch shell. This is our way of calling them to say hello, ancestors. This is for you, and I call you and honor you. I'd like to introduce Pinky. She's really very pink. So a little bit of my background. I'm an army angel because I'm the eldest in my family. So I'm not the brat. My little baby sister was the brat. She's not anymore. She's a good mother. But she couldn't imagine how she used to throw tantrums on the floor like in the movies. It was like, I can't believe it, you know. And her children are so beautiful. My niece and my nephew. I honor my mother as my first teacher in music as well as in healing. When I was like little, like 7, 8 years old, she would always ask me to massage her back in the evenings. And she had a very healing touch. I remember when we were living in Germany, and there was a little bird that was hopping around and could not fly. She took it in under her care, fed milk to it with an eyedropper. And then when the bird was healed and well, together we let the bird fly out the window. So it turns out that I am what is known as Suhi. Suhi is breached. I'm a breached baby. And in Southeast Asian philosophy, if you are a breached baby, you're a natural healer. And I found that only out, you know, just a couple of decades ago. I came actually here looking for the occult, for the mystery. I was a professional astrologer back in the Philippines, where my ancestors are from. I'm Filipino as well as Spanish. Reconciling the conqueror and the conquered in my blood. And so my mother was my first music teacher. She played piano and sang all the time. We were always singing in the family. She said I was singing since I was 10 months old. Of course, I didn't remember that, but that's what she always used to say. And so everybody in our family, we all sing. I remember, too, that with the music, I just took it for granted until I heard people saying, oh, I can't sing. I was told to mouth the words. I was told to pretend I'm singing. I was told I was too loud. I was told I was too soft. I was, you know, I can't sing. And then I made that like a music ministry to help people discover their voice. So I became a music teacher, voice teacher, all kinds of stuff with regards to music and healing. So I'm also a certified sound healer. But mostly I sing my writings. I remember that when I was a kid, 7, 8, 9 years old, you know, in elementary school, I was a prolific bookworm. So Friday after school, I would go to the library, check out like 10 books from the library. Then I'd go off to the woods, build a fort, and over the weekend, I would read those 10 books and then bring them back on Monday back to the library. So I was like so immersed that sometimes I wouldn't hear my father calling me, "Emily, what are you reading? What are you reading?" And he would take several minutes before I would even like come out of the stories. So I just love fairy tales. I love all kinds of stories and reading everything. Nowadays, I don't read as much, but I have been doing a little bit of reading. I grew up Roman Catholic, and when I was going to an all-girls Catholic school back in the Philippines, when my father retired from the U.S. Army, we went back there. One of our assignments, our sevas, was to teach in the public schools. So at the age of 14, I was teaching catechism and, you know, with a lesson plan and everything. But I always left out the stuff that even at an early age, I didn't totally agree with like, why are women always put down? So I didn't teach the Adam and Eve story. I taught other things, more about values, you know, and good things to do and the goodness in everything and inspiration and being inspired by that. I rely a lot on my intuition and for my creativity, and I've taken up a lot of my mother's legacy of music and healing, but also with crocheting. So you can see back here, I mean, made the baby Yodas, or actually known now as Grogu. and also sewing, but because I don't have a permanent place right now, I can't bring out my sewing machine or anything like that. But that's speaking about creativity and all of that. I'd like to read a few of the songs that I've written. And here, let me go to that. Because I sing, like I said, I sing my songs. So here's a song that I wrote a long time ago. This was almost 20 years ago. It's based on a poem by Starhawk from her Fifth Sacred Thing book. And the line that I based this on is, "There is a place for you at my table." And I've sung it at UU services too, during communion. "There is a place for you at my table, enough room, enough for all. Quench your thirst, satisfy your hunger, share these gifts of earthly life. There is love for you at my table, enough love, enough for all. Share the joy, share the wonder, share the mystery, share the light. There is peace for you at my table, enough peace, enough for all. Come to me from over yonder, share the beauty, share this time. You are welcome at my table, share the fruits of field and vine. Come to me away from thunder, share the nectar, share the wine. There is a place for you, there is love for you, there is peace for you. You are welcome at my table. There is a place at my table for you." Thank you. What else was I gonna say? Oh yeah, so like, yeah, so with all of this other, my mother was a wonderful, wonderful homemaker. She, of course, gave up her dream of becoming a lawyer to travel with my father, and my father took us everywhere. We lived in Italy and in Germany. And I've always been attracted to sounds. And so I've also been attracted to the sounds of languages. And so I've become very interested and also very, very curious about the pronunciation of words. So I want to make sure that I speak and sing the language the way a native would speak it. So I do a lot of research and study the IPA, which is not the drink, but the International Phonetic Alphabet, IPA. And so that the pronunciation, like for example, I sing in 34 languages. Some of them are Sanskrit, Latin, English. As my as my first language, actually, because my parents didn't want to teach us Filipino, you know, wanted us to fit in culture, Spanish, French, and so a lot of these languages, and Bulgarian languages as well, Georgian. And all of those beautiful languages. And it's just so beautiful to hear the sounds and to really go deep. If in chanting in the mantras, actually has a deity associated with it. So although I was raised Roman Catholic, I quickly engaged myself in studying Hinduism and Buddhism and earth-based spirituality. So I came over here to find that, like I said, the occult, only to discover that back in the Philippines, there are the natural healers there called either the Babaylan, depending if you're from Mindanao, or the Catalonan from the Tagalog region. Tagalog means Taga Ilog, which means from the river. So there's the river that comes down southern Luzon, central Luzon. So and also the Filipino language I discovered because of singing, learning it from singing, is that it's very somatic. So when you're speaking to someone, it's very much thread in the language. It's not so much objective. It's always, always very subjective. I'd like to read another poem song, I guess you would call it, that I wrote. Okay, so I also like to set songs to music from poetry that I have. And so, where did it go? Okay, hold on. Okay, I'm gonna look for it, but there's a song called Elixir that I wrote the melody to, again, to a poem by Starhawk. I said, for the spiral dance that over 2,000 people always attend on Halloween, in person, but not the past year, of course, not this past 2020. I wrote this 2018, and actually have sung it also at the Unitarian service. So here's a poem by Starhawk that I set to music. And the amazing Katya played the organ on it, and it was just so grandiose. It just, whoa. It was just, gives me chills even just thinking about that arrangement. What if we could brew an elixir? It's called Elixir. An elixir that brought peace. Drop it into the water, and all hatred and war would cease. Would it smell like a redwood forest? Would it taste like the first autumn rain? Would it be green as a new leaf budding? Could it dissolve away our pain? What if we could stir up justice, could brew it in a cauldron of change, add some fairness and equality and equal parts of love and rage? Would it smell like a winter storm wind? Would it taste like water clear? Would it be every color of the rainbow? Would it melt away all fear? And the choruses, strong bone, clear sight, brave heart, shine bright. Just a one-liner. But magic doesn't work like magic. We can't just wave a wand or sip a doze. We make magic when we act with courage, together for what we love most. We'll be the wind that blows down the dead wind and the shifting of the ground beneath our feet. The herb that springs up when the fire has passed, healing water, clear and sweet. Strong bone, clear sight, brave heart, shine bright. We are the elixir of justice. We are the elixir of peace. With every stand we take, every change we make, freedom and love increase. We are the storm wind, the water, the rainbow, the loving heart and helping hand. Stir the brew of change and transformation to heal one another and the land. Strong bone, clear sight, brave heart, shine bright. So now I am going to sing you an actual song that I wrote during these COVID times, and that will end my message, my sharing to all of you. And so I hope you like it. I wrote this on my birthday month. All right. And so here is a challenge to everyone out there. Would you please write me a third verse? And what I'll do is I'll put the lyrics in the chat after I sing it. This too shall pass, and when at last we can say we're alive and we have survived, we offer space, we turn the page. We begin again, thanks for family and friends. Do, 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 do. Those who gave their lives, those who sacrificed, those who crossed over, we'll always remember. Remember their spirit shining, a silver lining, chiming bell, all is well. Their spirit shining, a silver lining, chiming a bell, all is well. So I need a third verse. Anyone up to writing a third verse to finish this song? This too shall pass, this too shall pass, this too shall pass.
Thank you. Thank you, Lynn, and thank you, Deborah, and thank you, Evelie. That was such a wide range of thought and experience, and yet it all comes down to something that we can share with others that I found so beautiful, every one of you. Thank you so much. And I was thinking about the whole idea of stillness and the way our society has been working lately with so much electronic media, social media, the whole thing, that we don't have stillness very much anymore. And now that we have so much going on in our world and the pandemic at the same time, maybe this is a time for us to be reflective and find the stillness in ourselves to increase our own creativity and hopefully make a better world. So that's my little soapbox comment for today. We are open to questions. If you would like to go down to the participants section and raise your hand, Lonnie will call on you in the order that you sign in. And thank you all for attending.
I want to say first again, like Anne said, thank you so much, and to our speakers. Lynn Hammond is the reason why I write the emails that I do and the messages at church and the little homilies with some critical words that she said to me. She said, what does this feel like to you when you say that? What does this feel like? And she has been the source of my writing, a great, great teacher. And Deborah, your poetry has just, you know, made me come out the top of my head sometimes when it's actually psychically scary because I just lift out of my body. So I thank you for that. And of course, our dear Evelie, I will write you a third verse, Evelie. That is an exquisite song that maybe we'll do it as a church endeavor. That was absolutely wonderful. So we are looking for some questions now. And if there's no questions to our speakers, maybe somebody would like to just talk about the creativity, something that stimulated you in the talk, or commitments that you have for this new year about maybe some creative commitment that you want to make to yourself. Come on, Sherry Bell, I know you have something, you know. Hillary, Don, I can see it, Helen. Carol Carlisle.
Nora's got her hand up.
All right.
I couldn't get the participant thing to come up and let me do a electronic hand. But I really liked Jane Hammond's talking about creativity and how she opens people up to not doing what the teacher wants, but doing what's in their heart. And I realized for myself, I realized all of a sudden, listening to everybody about my influences on my writing, I've been working on writing poetry myself with Donna Davis. And and all of a sudden I realized, oh, the other things I do in my life are what directs my poetry. And that is Tai Chi, where you sort of learn about how to center and things like that, and nature and politics. So that was very interesting to me. And also it brought to mind my eighth grade experience, my first paper I had to write. And that was, our teacher told us to describe our hand, but we weren't allowed to use anything like fingernails, skin, knuckles, any of those words. We had to find different words to write about our hand. And I think maybe that was the first thing that got me to love words and their meanings and their double meanings and secondary meanings and things like that. I don't know if anybody else wants to say anything, but I was thinking about a poem I wrote about Tai Chi, and I didn't know if there was time for me to read it. But anybody else who'd like to speak, please go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to say something piggybacking on stillness, because I have a practice, a daily practice of meditation every day, sometimes twice a day. And I really love it that I can stay in meditation longer and in silence after chanting. It's just that what happens with the chanting is that you're not really so much in your mind, but you're in your heart. And so once that happens, you're also, because of sound healing and vibrating, you're vibrating all of the inner organs in your body. And so then when you finish the chant, you allow the song to just breathe, or the chant to breathe in silence. And then you can go, for me, at least my experience is to go, be able to go deeper into silence for a longer period of time than if I just went straight into meditation or silence. So the chanting actually helps me to sit longer. So even an hour or more. So that's my take on stillness, and I love it so much. I love it. Stillness to me, silence. I wrote a short poem. Sometimes silence is a poem.
Beautiful. Hillary was next. Hillary, can you come off mute?
I just wanted to say I'm so grateful to all three of you for reintroducing me to the spirit of creativity. As a younger person, it filled me. But as I've aged and with the COVID, I've kind of settled into not having the energy for it. And I'm grateful to the three of you for the way you opened the door again to that wonderful feeling. So thank you.
Beautiful. Cordell.
I'm still feeling the idea of stillness. And it occurred to me that I love metaphors. And during the day, the sun is so bright. Of course, we can't imagine what the stars would look like. But stillness is sort of like when the sun is set, you've kind of dampened that super bright light, and you suddenly find out there's an enormous amount of beauty and an additional qualities that have become apparent in that darkness. So it's a metaphor that occurred to me when I went, if you can set your sun, then you can gaze at the midnight sky, and you'll find that, you know, the Milky Way and the constellations are there, and they also speak, you know. So much of our mythology comes out of that. The patterns in the heavens at night and what they invoke in our imagination. So stillness is, to me, it actually feels physical. It's like you really are simply quieting your mind so that other parts of your mind that are speaking can be heard. By the way, Deborah, I want to talk to you about your muse. It's so familiar to me. It's almost as if you're speaking thoughts that I've had, thoughts that arrested me while I was washing dishes, but that arrested me and passed through. And you really plug into that in such a precise way that it makes me wonder and wants to investigate it. But you have the literary equivalent of perfect pitch.
Oh my goodness. Thank you, Cordell. I was just sitting here thinking that metaphor that you expressed about stillness is beautiful. And I would love to hear a poem that you wrote based on that.
Oh, you suspected I write poems.
Well, you certainly speak poetically.
Okay.
I wouldn't be well surprised.
It's true. I don't call myself a poet, but every now and then I'll recognize, I go, maybe that sort of seems poetic, but I want to identify. I'm more like the engineer that Lynn was speaking about. It's like, I write geeky stuff, but there is another dimension. But that's not the first time I've observed that, but this seems like a good time to go, how do you experience writing? Because it feels so familiar. So when I really think I'm on and I'm able to express with a certain efficiency and clarity and preciseness, there's a certain state that goes with that and a certain requirement. I don't stop till I know I got the exact meaning and that it's expressed. And I just sense that that's part of your process.
Go ahead, Daniel.
Cordell, I don't consider myself a poet, yet I was writing songs. I was writing poetry for songs before Deborah came out of the closet. And, I think that the one criterion, looking back at those, is that I had to find a way to step outside of myself to do it. In other words, I could not think of myself, my image of myself, the persona that I hold in my mind, which is, of course, subject to question. But the thing is that if I could let go of that, if I could allow something to flow through me, it would be, I can't use the word superior, but it would be, I would feel like it had validity when I came back to it a day or two later. And I just want to say that there was an experience that that really drove us home with when Sandy Tremblay died in 2010. And I had been composing music, and there was a certain tuning that I wanted to work with, since I work with tunings that are not our C major scale kind of stuff. I was sitting, and there was a big rain, a very brief but huge rainfall. And there was a plum tree blooming outside of the window of the room I was sitting in. And when the rain stopped, I opened my door, and the petals were blowing in the wind. The petals that had been loosened by the rain were blowing in the wind. And I suddenly was able to write in this new tuning, and the poetry and the melody flowed together. And I wasn't there.
I know exactly. Oh, wow. That was deep, Daniel. I really getting out of my own way. But there's some words for that. The great poets talk about that still space. And Nori, I'm dying to hear that poem that you wrote to Tai Chi about still space, if you have it close by.
I do have it.
I would love to hear that.
Okay, thank you. I took the phrase somnambulism of nature from Robinson Jeffries. To fuse with the somnambulant nature of existence, dive deep in to the muscular womb of darkness with barely the flutter flick of a minnow, lest it collapse into an impenetrable black hole the size of a pinprick. Prune the trailing threads that furrow openings on dust bunnies of dog hair, a sink holding encrusted dishes, a desk shrunk under the jetsam of posted taxes not yet filed in the trash. Best bring in their stead the buds of your garden, the fig tree with its roots and soil. Tie a sailor's knot in the hawser to haul in the North Star and tow the heavens too. And settle in with your back against the fragile door, keeping out the evicted monkey brain.
Wow.
Thank you.
Wonderful. I've just reclassified you.
Really? Wow, that's wonderful. I have a little funny story to say about creativity, and I would love if the speakers and anybody could address it, which, you know, being monkey mind and busy all the time, I really, you know, and when I was growing up, you had your vocation and your avocation. Well, those can be hobbies, dear. You have to get a real job. Those can be, you know, it was art and that side of yourself was, you know, well, those were the avocation. Those were the hobbies. Those, you couldn't really do that as a serious commitment in life. And so I grew up like that. And particularly being African-American, it was, you know, finding jobs, getting work. It was a society that made that hard. So about 10 years ago, I went to the Richmond, they were having the African-American, the Black art experience. And I'm in this group of all African-American artists. I mean, incredible artists, poets. And when they had the time for the Q&A, they all gave beautiful presentations. I raised my hand and I said, don't you feel guilty? Like, you know, this is time that could be done feeding children or doing something, you know, I didn't say the word worthwhile, but it was in parens, and an entire group of people turned slowly and looked at me, and like, I just sat back in my seat, and I got such a barrage from, as only African-American women, the women just went, you know, tore me a new one. And I began to read more about creativity after that. And could somebody just talk about the guilt? Okay, maybe you don't have guilt, but it's like, you know, there's dishes to do. There's you know, taxes to do, as Nori said, you know, and anybody want to talk about
mission? I actually, it's quite true. We have duties and responsibilities, and I feel that it can be balanced out with our creative projects. Well, who knows how our creativity will affect other people. Maybe they'll be inspired to also, like somebody said, who was it that was inspired, that to come out of her own shell of not being creative the past several years. And with this shelter in place, it's ironic that I feel that I'm busier because I don't have to drive anywhere, which would take up the time to do other things. But we need to be joyful in our activism. We need to be joyful in our responsibilities and duties, because that's how we're able to keep our emotions stable and balanced and centered. Because if we give in to our depression or loneliness, this is how we can reach out to each other, is through this platform of having Zoom or whatever, FaceTime or however you want to do it. And at the same time, take the time for your own self, to nurture your own self, to bring in those beautiful garden fruits and plants and vegetables, and be creative. There are many ways of being creative. Everything can be creative, and everything can be meditation.
So, that's excellent. And Max says you have to fill yourself before you can fill others. And that's what artists know. And that's what you're saying, Evelyn. And that's very well said. I have to remember that.
I would add to that too. In our society, we always feel like we have to justify ourselves. We have to justify things. What's the value of that? But you're a sovereign spirit, and you don't have to justify what arises in your heart. That's someone else's agenda being expressed, to say, what does what you're doing and saying have to do with my bottom line? And that justification is something we should all stand up and go, excuse me, but my humanity is God's way of saying, I want you to be you. That's your existence. So you don't have to justify the mirth, the, you know, the muses and what they say, that, you know, can call it frivolous if you want, but we're all born the same way. from the same source. And so, you know, let it out. And some of us are marvelous and amazing when we do, and some of us are not so much, but it's okay. We all should have the green light.
I know, Cordell, but you know, you have mothers that tell you that, you know. And Judy Sam says, what is Judy saying in there?
All three of you brought a real sense of yourselves here beautifully, and for myself, you were able to invite me to join the space you inhabit so naturally. I travel farther from that realm than I'd realized, and I'm very grateful to each of you. What a gift, especially at this time. Wow. Judy Sam.
Thank you, Judy. Daniel G has had his hand up for quite a while, and I noticed.
Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. Hey, I just wanted to say hello and thank our good friend, Lynn. My wife, on behalf of my wife, Marilyn, and I, we're neighbors, have known Lynn just for a short time, for 2 years. But I just wanted to say thank you so much for inviting us to be part of your group this morning. Thank you for the three different messages, all which were different but perfectly harmonized. And I just wanted to say it as a real gift to me to start our day, and I appreciate this opportunity.
Wow! Thank you for being with us. We appreciate your attendance.
Come back.
Yeah.
Lynn is a stalwart advocate for your heart. What your heart is trying to say, she'll give it space to say it. So she'll.
Thank you for your support, Lynn. Yeah, thank you for your support of our dear Lynn.
Yes.
All right, my dear friends, we're at 10:43. You know, we need to break to go to worship. But someone asked a very interesting request. If Evely could lead us maybe a 1 minute chant. Now, I'm putting you on the spot, Evely, but if you come off mute.
As a matter of fact, I also make drums. So I made this drum made out of gourd. And I wanted to use it because this is a good song to chant. It's actually a Mayan chant. Enlak etch anlak en, which means I am another you, you are another me. So we'll do this call response and keep yourself muted. All right. Enlak etch.
Enlak etch.
Please keep yourself
muted.
Yeah. Let's do that again. And luggage. And luggage. On luggage. On luggage. And luggage. And luggage. On luggage. On luggage. I am another you. I am another you. You are another me. You are another me. I am another you. I am another you. You are another me. You are another me. And luggage. Unlocking. And luggage. Unlocking. I am another you. You are another me. I am another you. You are another me.
Love that. That's wonderful.
Amazing.
Yeah. Thank you. And I added several other languages, but yeah, no time for that.
Thank you, Evely. Thank you. Oh.
Yeah. Well, I don't need service. I'm gonna skip that. Just kidding.
Aww.
Thanks, everyone. We do need to sign off. One thing I really wanted to say about personal theology this particular year with COVID is we've had an opportunity, and today's a good example of learning more about our members and those who make our church so special. And like I've known Lynn for 20 some years, but I learned some things today. And thank you for your share. And if anybody else would like to be a part of a personal theology program, please let myself or Lynn know. Wasn't that smooth?